This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Saturday, March 30th, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Talks between Israel and the U.S. may be back on as soon as this coming week, but relations between our two countries are tense as American support for Israel declines.
This has been America's policy that was for calling for a temporary ceasefire in return for the release of hostages. And all of a sudden that changed.
I'm Chad Pergram. Will Congress fund a new bridge in Baltimore? Chaos in the House, and an exclusive interview with Democratic Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania.
Congress is gone for 2 weeks for Easter, Chad, but when they return, they've got a huge priority because, of course, President Biden just said that it's his intention that Congress and the federal government will work together to reconstruct the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. This past week began with a vote at the UN Security Council. 14 of 15 countries voted for a resolution calling for a ceasefire during the rest of Ramadan in Gaza, as well as a release of the Israeli hostages. The U.S. did not veto this resolution, but rather abstained. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. ambassador to the UN.
Still, certain key edits were ignored, including our request to add a condemnation of Hamas. And we did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would no longer be sending a delegation of senior leaders to discuss future military plans in the Gazan city of Rafah, where most of the population has fled to the south, given the war to the north. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby insisted the vote was in keeping with U.S. policy.
We're kind of perplexed by this.
By midweek, Florida Republican Senator Rick Scott was meeting Netanyahu in Jerusalem, and Netanyahu explained himself further.
My decision not to send the delegation to Washington in the wake of that resolution was a message to Hamas. It was a message, first and foremost, to Hamas. Don't bet on this pressure. It's not going to work. And I hope they got the message.
A few hours after that meeting, Netanyahu announced he'd reversed course and would send a delegation to the U.S. Kirby said Thursday they were working out the details.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into the sausage making here one way or the other. I'll just tell you that we are currently discussing rescheduling that meeting on Rafah with the Prime Minister's office and our Israeli counterparts.
In the end, Netanyahu has also said they do plan to go into Rafah with or without the U.S. support to take out Hamas. Kirby's previously said on this podcast they want to share with the Israelis American perspectives on military action, regardless of when or how Israel goes in.
Well, I can explain this. I'm not a spokesman for Benjamin Netanyahu or for the Israeli government. I'm a private citizen.
Former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren.
I was asked by the Israeli media whether I thought it was a good decision not to send Ron Dermer and Tzachi Hanegbi to Washington. And I thought it was a good decision, although that decision was regretted slash denounced by the Biden administration. And the reason I said that was that the United States had backtracked significantly on its policy. It had cast three vetoes in the Security Council against attempts to unilaterally impose an unconditional and permanent ceasefire on Gaza, which meant that Hamas would win and Israel would lose. Hamas would get away with mass murder and there would be no release of hostages. And this has been America's policy that was for calling for a temporary ceasefire in return for the release of hostages. And all of a sudden that changed. There were two resolutions that were passed thanks to an abstention by the United States, which in the Security Council was like voting for it. You may recall that back in 2016, Resolution 2334 condemning Israel for its settlements was passed by Security Council when the Obama administration abstained, didn't vote for it, but abstained. So these two resolutions created parallel paths. One called for the release of hostages, but the other called for a permanent and unconditional ceasefire. But they weren't related. They weren't conditioned on one another. So it was a fundamental change in the U.S. position, even though a spokesman for the administration, John Kirby, denied it and said there was a continued conditionality.
And right. He said there was a link in the resolution. You're saying there wasn't between. So the link was that if you have a ceasefire, even if it's temporary during Ramadan, that we will have a release of hostages. You're saying that that resolution actually was not linking those two items.
Were not linked. There were two separate resolutions that were not linked. The administration said there's no change of policy, but that's not within the text. And the fact of the matter is, as far as the Security Council is concerned, America can have its interpretation, but the Security Council text stands. And that, you know, I think the proof was in the fact that both Hamas and Iran praised the resolutions. I don't think you have to look any further than that.
But
and it came at a time of it didn't come in that vacuum. It came at a time when the vice president was saying that if Israeli forces enter Rafah, there'd be consequences. The intimation is there'd be some kind of a reduction in American support, either diplomatic or logistical support for Israel. The Schumer remark calling for elections and basically the downfall of the Netanyahu government. It comes with a long list of actions by the Biden administration that didn't exactly build up trust with the Israeli government and actually convinced Hamas that all it has to do is sit tight in Rafah and eventually the United States and Israel would break and the United States would begin calling for a ceasefire. And these two resolutions tended to reinforce that image. So I thought it was important that Israel send a message that it wasn't going to be business as usual.
But the message didn't last. Netanyahu, the prime minister, has since reversed course and he said he will send a delegation. Do you think something happened in meeting with Florida Senator Rick Scott that changed his mind? Because he announced that he was reversing course like within hours of meeting the senator.
I don't know if it happened. I wasn't privy to that meeting. But I think that at a certain point you have to say, okay, I've sent the message of displeasure. It has been received. And now we can go back and try to mend some of these fences that have been so very publicly if not torn down, certainly publicly rendered and rent. And I think, okay, that's the way diplomacy works. I think the message was sent. It was, I think, an appropriate message. It would have been wrong for those two emissaries to come the day after those two resolutions were accepted. And it'd be very good if they come back next week.
It does seem that, you know, the fight to get hostages back, including young girls, like 19-year-old girls, is being overshadowed by these discussions of weakened political support. I'm sure you're having private conversations. I wonder what you can share with us about your sense of how serious this is, what appears to be less political support from the U.S., and the effect that's having, if it's having any effect at all, on talks to get people back.
Well, it certainly has an effect. And again, it's not my interpretation. Just have to listen to what Sinwar is saying, the commander of Hamas in Gaza, what he's saying. He was quoted in the Wall Street Journal, a memo several weeks ago, saying, listen, I have the Israeli army where I want them. They're bogged down in Gaza. Israel's isolated in the world, and there are increasing strains in the U.S.'s relationship. All I do have to do is sit quietly, let Israel kill more Palestinian civilians, and eventually the United States will demand a ceasefire. And he's been led to believe that this is the case. And I can adduce evidence to the fact that, yeah, that seems pretty convincing that he has been led to believe this. And then for American negotiators to then go and try to get hostages released in return for a temporary ceasefire, why would Sinwar give up assets? And I hate to, you know, think of hostages as assets, but certainly Hamas thinks of them as assets in return for a temporary ceasefire, after which Israel will renew the war to destroy Hamas. Hamas won't gain anything. It'll gain a couple of weeks of quiet. That's not going to do them any good if their backs are up against the wall of Rafah. So yeah, I think that the United States, by issuing these comments, has greatly weakened its own negotiating position in the hostage release negotiations and strengthened the hand of Hamas.
Tell me a little bit more, though, about the overshadowing of things by the politics of this, because a Gallup poll now finds less support for Israel among Americans. 55% do not support Israel's actions. And that's a pretty big decline from where it was a couple months ago. Does that even factor into discussion right now, or does that really not matter, even if it slips further? I mean, Netanyahu has said Israel will go into Rafah alone if it has to.
That's true. Israel will go into Rafah alone if we have to. We'll fight Hamas with sticks and stones if we have to. But it'd be better if we don't have to. It'd be better if we have adequate munitions, if we had public opinion solidly behind us, certainly a majority of public opinion. And Israel here, I must say, has dropped the ball. I'm in Washington, D.C. for discussions with the leaders of the American Jewish community, and they feel, for the large part, abandoned by the Israeli government, not giving information. So, for example, when American officials talk about 30 or 32,000 Palestinians dead and how there cannot be another 32,000 Palestinians killed by Israel, that's a false number. And not only does Hamas routinely fabricate grossly inflate its numbers, and many of the statistics that that Hamas has produced are statistically impossible. Like, for example, you can't have 78% of the population be women and children. And that's what they're claiming. But beyond that, that number includes the 14 to 15,000 terrorists that Israel has killed. It includes the Palestinians who have been killed by Palestinian rockets falling short. About 30% of their rockets fall short. And includes even people who just die in Gaza. And so if you look at that statistic and you deduct all these other factors, you get something close to a one combatant death to 1.2 civilian deaths, which, you know, any civilian death is a tragedy. But in modern warfare terms, that is an ultimate record. And the United States was fought in Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq. It was between four civilians to every combatant to nine civilians to every combatant. And so to say that Israel is acting savagely toward the Palestinians, it's just the opposite. To say that Israel is bombing indiscriminately is simply untrue. Every bombing operation goes through a lengthy process of approval, including legal approvals. That doesn't mean mistakes don't happen, but to say that Israel is bombing indiscriminately is untrue. So, but these American Jewish leaders I was spoken to did not receive that information. And I was fortunate to be able to bring them, say, a high-ranking Air Force general who explained this position. I was able to bring them somebody from the coordinator of policy toward the territories in charge of humanitarian aid in the territories in Gaza, who will say that there's no delays on the Israeli side. The delay is all on the distribution side of aid into Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. So Israel has to do a far, far better job of explaining its case. Certainly to the American Jewish community specifically, but more broadly to the American public and to the global community.
Just a couple more for you. The UN's High Court has ordered Israel to open more land crossings to allow food and aid in. That's an order, apparently. I just want to know, how big of a risk is that to Israel, as even folks at the White House make the same demand to do more, to get more aid in?
It's not a risk. The problem is not opening the border crossings. The problem is distribution. It's getting the aid either from the beach where America wants to build its pier or from the border crossings into Gaza itself. Because once you go into Gaza, you're in a different universe. That is when thousands of people will rush these convoys and try to grab food off the trucks. It's where armed Palestinians, and these are Palestinians either are from various clans and tribes, they're armed, and Hamas itself, which is armed, will try to sort of requisition the aid and then either keep it for itself or sell it at inflated prices in the markets of Gaza. It's a business.
Wow.
And if the only the UN today is, and other relief agencies are afraid to escort and distribute this aid. The only entity that is capable of doing this is the Israeli army. And when you see the Israeli army going in, they're getting blamed for massacres they didn't commit. So it's a no-win situation for us. But again, we haven't explained this situation sufficiently clearly to the world.
Finally, this is the look ahead, right? Everybody talks about this, especially the Western media, about what's going to happen once this winds down. And there's more discussion about the future. With the PA taking over, with the Palestinian Authority taking over Gaza, and this continued talk of a two-state solution. We all know a two-state solution was on the table for years. How different?
About 31 years.
How different does the conversation look now prospectively about a two-state solution given what has happened?
Well, there's different conversations about the two-state solution. The Europeans want to impose a two-state solution unilaterally. The United States and the Saudis want us to discuss a pathway to a Palestinian state. The overwhelming majority of Israelis are dead set against it. They understand that a Palestinian state under its current leadership, which is Mahmoud Abbas, now in the 19th year of his four-year term, is thoroughly corrupt and unpopular, and that 85% of the Palestinians in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, support Hamas. So it's just as our own president, Isaac Herzog, former head of the Labor Party, said, talking about a Palestinian state now is sheer madness. And it is sheer madness. Now, having said all that, you know, I think that Israel should offer to discuss whatever President Biden wants to discuss. It doesn't obligate us in any way. And if it provides more time and space for the IDF to operate, including in Rafah, we should do it. But, you know, politics being politics in Israel as well in the United States, it doesn't leave a lot of room for maneuverability. But that's what I think we should do, show that type of flexibility. I'm all about time and space for the IDF. And whatever constricts that space, we should avoid.
Former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in freefall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
I'm here with my colleague, Aisha Hazmi, and Congress is out, but that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, Congress is gone for 2 weeks for Easter, Chad, but when they return, they've got a huge priority because, President Biden just said that it's his intention that Congress and the federal government will work together to reconstruct the Francis Scott Key Bridge after that just horrific collapse, just a tragic, tragic story that's unfolding. It's going to take weeks and months to investigate, but, you know, there's also Baltimore is sort of going to be paralyzed until this bridge is rebuilt. So talk to us about how quickly Capitol Hill can take action.
Well, here's the model. So in 2007, there was a bridge that collapsed in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. It was the I-35 West Bridge. It collapsed on August 1st. And it happened to be that year that Jim Oberstar, who's not with us anymore, but he was the chairman of the Transportation Committee, and he was from Minnesota. This was not in his district. Would you believe, Aisha, that, and this was a major thoroughfare through Minnesota, and if you think about the economic impact on the United States of that interstate highway and that bridge there, and then multiply that geometrically in terms of the Port of Baltimore and the economic impact
massive
in the United States, it's unbelievable. They passed that bill 2 or 3 days later, 421-0 in the House. It went to the Senate. They made one change.
Were they on break, too?
No, not quite yet. Okay. That happened a couple of days later. In fact, I remember this, but I looked it up, but it was right before the August recess. Mm-hmm. They made one change in the Senate. They passed it unanimously. They bounced it back to the House of Representatives, and they took the Senate version and passed it without even a roll call vote. They UC'd it, or unanimous consent, as we call it on Capitol Hill. President George W. Bush signed it into law 5 days later.
Wow.
And they had the new bridge built and open 13 months later.
Wow.
So we're not in 2007. This is a bigger bridge, more economic impact. And guess what? We're in a very acrimonious political period. They could barely keep the government open last week. And keep in mind, what sort of headache is this going to cause for Mike Johnson, the Speaker
of
the House?
Well, Mike Johnson, yes, has quite a few headaches on his hands. Not only the shifting balance of power in the House with Congressman Ken Buck leaving, and then Congressman Mike Gallagher is expected to leave early now. So we're down to he can only lose two after that. So he's in quite a bit of a bind, but he's also got this, I don't know, this thing called motion to vacate hanging over his head now.
I want my MTV.
Uh-huh.
Didn't we say that back in the
80s? MTG filing an MTV. That's a great headline. Look, I mean, you talk about spending and government funding is a huge battle you know, a challenge for Republicans in the House and in the Senate. This was kind of a repeat of what happened last fall, right? When former Speaker Kevin McCarthy had to fund the government, two conservatives, some hardliners, Freedom Caucus members didn't like that, didn't like this now. But no one, Chad, and I had asked plenty of times to several different people, no one was interested in filing a motion to vacate this time, except Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene had kind of hinted it before the actual vote on the $1.2 trillion government funding bill started to take place. And as we're watching the House floor and people are voting, we're watching Greene sort of walk over to the hopper and drop a resolution into it.
That became the story, not the vote on funding the government.
And all of a sudden, there's all these, you know, people are whispering and people are trying to figure out what did she do. And the next thing you know, yes, it came out that she'd filed this motion to vacate. Now, I will say it's different this time. She has not made it privileged. It's not live. So that means that it's sort of a threat hanging over the speaker. And it gives her 2 weeks now, one, for press. Anybody that talks to any lawmaker out there for the next 2 weeks will ask certainly about this whole motion to vacate. But then it also gives her time to sort of negotiate something, whatever she wants, with Speaker Johnson. And I'm hearing that might have something to do with, some sources are telling me, a possible upcoming vote on foreign aid that could be attached to border. We don't know what that, you know, package might look like yet. There's just rumblings of it coming out of the Senate. But if this is something that's backed by Johnson, backed by, let's say, former President Trump, that would be really tough for Marjorie to basically oppose. So we're still sort of waiting to see what she might try to negotiate to not make this privileged.
And this was very similar to what Mark Meadows did when he was a congressman from North Carolina in the summer of 2015. He wrote a resolution, very same to what Marjorie Taylor Greene did the other day, and he did not trigger it right away. Mm-hmm. And he kind of held this over the head of John Boehner, then the Speaker of the House, as this sort of Damocles. And John Boehner, by the fall, saw the writing on the wall, and he resigned and stepped aside. And that kind of started this whole thing. The one thing that's always surprised me about this entire scenario, and this goes back to Kevin McCarthy, this deal he kind of made with the devil to make sure that he could become the Speaker, was that they reduced the universe of votes way down to just one.
Right.
Any member could call for a new vote for Speaker of the House. And after Mike Johnson was elected, they've never changed it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's astonishing.
And he's not in a hurry to change it. That might change now, but
yeah, exactly.
He's never asked for that to be changed.
But it paralyzes the House when you get into
yeah.
this. And I think that was the thing that a lot of people were reluctant to go ahead and pull the trigger on something like this, because they saw the chaos that this threw the House into in the fall. And it took them 22 days. They burned through, you know, three other speaker candidates, you know, Jim Jordan, Tom Emmer, Steve Scalise. So it's not like there's somebody else out there who magically
right.
can step
in. Right. Who else
in.
Is out there?
So if it took them 22 days in the fall, how long is it going to take them then? And I'll tell you this, newsflash right now, you talk about this bill that we don't know much about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's several different iterations of this, dealing with Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, maybe something with border. Brian Fitzpatrick, the Republican mm-hmm. from Pennsylvania, has this. If that bill moves in some form, that is going to be the vehicle for money for this bridge in Baltimore.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Well, we'll see how quickly they can do it. There will be certainly a lot of pressure on them to move as quickly as possible because, again, you've got, you know, tens of thousands of people that live in and around the Baltimore area that just, I mean, like I said, just you talk about
35,000 vehicles a day.
Yeah. What a commuter town. They have to get back to work. They have to get back to business. It's very troubling to watch. And of course, the tragedy of just the families that are waiting to see if they can recover any bodies. Talk to me about a very interesting sit-down interview, kind of an exclusive you got with Senator John Fetterman. Just a very interesting character, personality. Started off sort of not really out there very much, had a bit of problems, health issues. And now, man, he's a soundbite machine, Chad.
Yeah, he had a stroke during the campaign. He then checked himself into a hospital here in Washington, D.C., just a couple of weeks after he was sworn into the Senate, suffering from depression. And the problem that he's had, and this seems to have contributed to the depression, is that he had trouble processing audio and speaking. Mm-hmm. And so what's happened, and you and I have kind of watched this evolution, it's just not that he's kind of, you know, inserted himself and kind of found his rhythm in the Senate. But sometimes that rhythm is very different than what other rank and file members of the Democratic Party think and the line that they want to toe. You know, I had done an interview with him a few weeks ago where he said, hey, I am of a mind that I support most of H.R. 2. That's the House's very strict border security package here. He said, with the exception of provisions for DACA and things like that, he said, that's something that's important to me. He said, we need to do something about the border. He told me in the interview that he said people portrayed me and said I was a progressive. He said, I'm not a progressive. He has opposed a lot of the liberals in his party on the issue of the Middle East.
And Israel.
Yeah.
He's very pro-Israel.
Exactly, exactly. And then the other thing that he's outspoken about, and I put it to him this way, I said, I'm going to give you a name, and I want you to respond. And I said, Bob Menendez, the Democratic senator from New Jersey. And of course, he's called him a sleazeball. He doesn't understand why his other colleagues don't try to move to expel him from the Senate. You know, as he put it, he said this is Bob Menendez's second trip to the prom. You know, he was, accused several years ago, had a trial, was exonerated in that trial. And so he said, you know, they made a bigger fuss about me wearing a hoodie around the Senate than they are worried about the conduct of Bob Menendez. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. So this is going to be an evolving story watching John Fetterman. And I know the other thing that's interesting when you talk to him, he has a device, an app on his phone.
Tell us about that, because this has really been a game changer for him.
It changed everything, because if he's having trouble processing the audio, when you interview him, he sees the words that you speak on the screen, and then he looks at his phone and then sees what he's saying, and that helps him kind of keep track of the conversation. And it's just a simple device, but it does it in real time. And that's how he's able to conduct interviews, and he hears everything fine. It just does something to help it. I was really intrigued by this. I wear eyeglasses.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it's kind of like you wearing eyeglasses. You use that as a tool to help you read and see and everything else. He said it's the same. Mm-hmm. It's the same process. And he also talked about this whole idea of mental health. You know, he co-chairs the Mental Health Caucus in the Senate along with Tom Tillis, the Republican senator from North Carolina, and says, you know, there's an exorbitant number of suicides that are, you know, people commit each day. He said, you know, look, he said, I want to use this as a bit of a platform. If people, you know, are suffering or need help, or there's a friend or a loved one or a colleague.
I love that.
Can you do something with
that? That's great.
I want to ask you about one other thing here that you've been covering the past few days. So they passed in the House of Representatives the Laken Riley Act.
Yes.
And you interviewed—
Bipartisan.
And you interviewed Mike Collins, the Republican from Georgia, who sponsored the resolution, sponsored the bill, and the death happened in his district.
Right.
It's not going anywhere in the Senate.
Right. And, you know, there was a big push, a last minute push to get it into this government funding bill. But at the end of the day, the Democrats, you know, their reasoning is that they couldn't get it in because it would amend the entire bill. They'd have to send it back to the House. And they were up against that midnight deadline to fund the government. And the House, of course, you know, got out of Dodge fairly quickly. I mean, it was a jailbreak on that Friday. So they were really under the gun. They just couldn't do it without having to shut down the government for 2 weeks or having
they tried to amend the bill, right?
Ted
Budd, the Republican from North Carolina.
Exactly. So it's still there. It's still sort of hanging out there in the Senate. And so Mike Collins, yeah, I caught up with him, and he's still pretty hopeful that he can keep the momentum going. And the way that he's trying to do this is he's trying to reach out and get a co-sponsor, a Democrat senator from Georgia, to get in on this with him. So he's reached out to Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, and he told me that he's had really good conversations with them. They have a few questions. I think Warnock had a few concerns and questions about the language of the bill. They're trying to figure this out. But he thinks that that might actually help, you know, this bill be shepherded through the Senate and actually come to the daylight. What's interesting is, you know, he talks with the family of Laken Riley, and we still haven't heard from them because they're grieving. Rightly so. But I asked, you know, what do they think about this bill? And he said one of his first conversations with the family was they said, if Congress can do anything to prevent another family from having to suffer the heartache
and the pain that they are going through right now, then do it. And so he's got the endorsement, it seems like, from the family. And I think that will go a long way when it comes to Ossoff and Warnock. I don't know if they've had conversations with the family, but I would imagine this issue is not going away. And if Congress can do maybe even just a little bit, not necessarily in a massive border bill, but something sort of tangent, it would go a long way.
And tell us what the bill does.
So the bill, yeah, I mean, it's a list for some progressives, it's definitely controversial, but it basically gives ICE the authority to detain an illegal immigrant that commits a burglary, theft, larceny, something like that. Any brush with the law, you know, something like shoplifting, which is what happened in the case of Lakin Riley's murder suspect. He was cited in New York, and then once again, I think he had a brush up with the law in Georgia. So there was a history, and what lawmakers, conservatives, and those that are on board with this bill, again, it was a bipartisan out of the House. I think over 30 Democrats right. signed on. So that tells you something, that people are ready to work together to make, you know, increment changes for the greater good. I mean, if this could help authorities give them a few more tools to do something about, you know, illegal immigrants here in this country, then they're saying that this is a good idea.
And this is one of the reasons why the Senate didn't vote right away mm-hmm. on that spending bill. And we kind of had a technical shutdown for a couple of hours.
Did. Although some people disagree that it was it a shut. Can we just, you know, put it to bed? I think it was a shutdown for at least two hours.
If the president has not signed it into law and
it's
the Senate didn't pass it until about 2:07 in the morning Saturday. So they were past the deadline there. But that was the whole holdup here, is that you had Republicans in the Senate who wanted these vulnerable Democrats who face competitive reelection bids this fall in red or swing states, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, John Tester in Montana, Bob Casey in Pennsylvania, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, to get on the record and take a tough vote mm-hmm. and either vote the thing down and then the Republicans say, aha, we got mm-hmm. you. You know, how's this going to go in a red state? Or,
well, there was this idea being offered up, and I can't quite remember. I think it might have been Senator Mike Lee who was talking with reporters about, you know, what if we just separate out those votes, you know, and do those later? But there's that promise that we will get to these votes and you'll have to vote for it. Not tonight, not government, you know, shutdown night. But
and those were the motions
the
they made.
Yes.
Those were part of those motions.
Yep.
So, but that issue is not going away. The border is not going away.
Nope.
We thought we had put government spending to bed until September, but that's going to come back right away with this debate over this bridge.
It's like deja vu all the time on Capitol Hill.
Well,
it's the same thing over and over again. Don't you feel that way sometimes?
It absolutely is. And just the fact, Aisha, that, you know, it took them until late March to fund the bills that were due in September.
Just a tad late.
And we turn right back around. I mean, they're making the spending request right now.
Yeah.
We're going to have this supplemental spending request in some form for this bridge. And here we go again, off to the races.
Here's my last question. Do you think Marjorie Taylor Greene makes that motion to vacate live?
I think it depends on whether or not a lot of Republicans, a lot of conservatives start to hear from their constituents. Now, here's an interesting parliamentary thing. It doesn't have to be Marjorie Taylor Greene. Mm. Somebody else can take that resolution. It's almost as though she's daring or tempting. Now, sometimes she has had some run-ins with Lauren Boebert, the Republican from Colorado, say, oh, you took my idea, Lauren, and they argue about it. But any member could take that resolution and make it live. I wondered for a hot minute if maybe a Democrat, just to kind of demonstrate how chaotic things are on the Republican side of the aisle, could do the same thing.
I don't think Democrats want to go down that road.
But here's the thing, is that that first vote, even if you made it live, would be on a motion to table. And that's
right.
exactly what happened with Kevin McCarthy
right.
in the fall. And so what you're doing is you're voting, first of all, say, okay, here's this resolution. We're not going to consider this. So you're one parliamentary step removed from that. What happened with McCarthy is the Democrats did not support the motion to table
right.
and the question. Now, of course,
well, Johnson could bring that up, too. He could try to get that motion to table going.
Exactly. And, you know, this is what Speaker, you know, Joe Cannon did more than 100 years ago. There was a similar resolution.
Yes,
you told me this story. You and I covered it. And he said, oh, so you want to kick me out? So he put the thing on the floor. Preserved his speakership, but won with all these votes from the other side mm-hmm. of the aisle. And on one hand, it weakened him, but it also, you know, he kept his job, and it forever kind of changed the speakership.
It does. I think it does weaken you, because then you basically, in which Johnson is already hearing from some members of his, you know, conference, you become the Democrat speaker. You become a speaker of the Democrats. So, I mean, do you really want the gavel if that's how you're labeled?
And this is where Pete Aguilar, the chairman of the Democratic caucus, said a few days ago. He says Hakeem Jeffries is not the Speaker of the House, but he's the leader of the Congress. And here's the thing to watch. You know, you asked me whether or not Marjorie Taylor Greene would put this into effect here. You talk about the math. I always talk about the math. You heard me say that a million times. This margin is going to be so tight. God forbid all it takes is somebody to pass away or somebody else to resign. You and I have talked about other members potentially resigning.
Right.
We've heard that for a while now. The Congress, the House of Representatives has never flipped control in the middle of a Congress. Everything else has happened this year, this Congress. Every other weird thing, that's about the only thing that hasn't happened.
Are you saying this is a year of firsts? I mean, we do, I think, have like two or three eclipses this month. So.
One goes right over my house in Ohio, so maybe that says something, Aisha.
I don't think I can take it.
Well, thank you, Aisha. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
That'll do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Tomorrow, we talk about the president's recent swing through some battleground states and which candidate's faring better with swing state voters for now. And then we talk about bipartisan support to possibly limit Chinese purchases of our agricultural land moving forward. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.